Now we find ourselves in a realm where the inner is visibly trying to get out, to express itself. The space we create is such that the source body, the innermost, can begin to radiate out. If your practice remains only at the physical level, the space essential to liberate the inner will be missing. The realization that each cell has its own intelligence through which to realize its brief existence will never come. You will remain locked in the dark density of matter, when what you are seeking is for that inner light to irradiate space. It is a shame to practice yoga so much and to this level, yet still remain encumbered with ego. One should be natural, like a happy, confident child. The soul seeks nothing more than to expand, to fill our whole being. But we still maintain an internal cringe, a sense of unworthiness, which we often mask by a projection of arrogant, false personality. This is just one of the inherent flaws which exist equally in intelligence. Impurities of intelligence. The whole educative thrust of yoga is to make things go right in our lives. But we all know that an apple which appears perfect on the outside can have been eaten away by an invisible worm on the inside. Yoga is not about appearances. It's about finding and eradicating the worm so that the whole apple, from skin inwards, can be perfect and a healthy one. That is why yoga, and indeed all spiritual philosophies, seem to harp on the negative. Grasping desires, weaknesses, faults, imbalances. They are trying to catch the worm before it devours and corrupts the whole apple from the inside. This is not a struggle between good and evil. It is natural for worms to eat apples. In yoga, we simply do not want to be the apple which is rotted from the inside. So yoga insists on examining, scientifically and without value judgment, what can go wrong and why, and how to stop it. It is organic farming of the self, for the self. To reach and penetrate as far as the fourth sheath is a considerable achievement. But I would be doing you a disservice if I did not point out that considerable achievements also bring in their wake considerable dangers. An obvious one is pride. Not satisfaction in a job well done, but a sense of superiority and difference, of distinction and eminence. It is an obsession in our modern society to focus on appearance, presentation, and packaging. We do not ask ourselves, how am I really? But how do I look? How do others see me? It is not a question of, what am I saying? But how do I sound? There are those, for example, who perform polished, well-presented, highly attractive yoga asana. They are pleased with this and with themselves and are perhaps financially well-rewarded for this outward excellence. When I was young, struggling to earn a living, to raise yoga in public esteem, to exemplify in my visible body the art and aesthetic beauty of yoga, I was always seeking to present asana in the best possible way, symmetrically, precisely, and in stimulating, coherent sequences. I was, when occasion demanded, a performer and an artist. This was my service to the art of yoga. But in my own personal practice, I did not have this type of idea. I was only concerned to explore, to learn, to challenge and transform inwardly. Above all, to penetrate. Yoga is an interior penetration leading to integration of being, senses, breath, mind, intelligence, consciousness, and self. It is definitely an inward journey, evolution through involution, towards the soul, which in its turn desires to emerge and embrace you in its glory. You need a good teacher as a guide so you will not hurt your body, overstretch, wrench, or nip the inner fibers, the tendons, ligaments, mind, and emotions. This is yoga inadequately or wrongly practiced. I know, I've done it. But when yoga is only outward-facing, exhibitive, and self-gratifying, it is not yoga at all. Such an attitude will deface and deform even the character you started out with. In class, when pride rises, or its complement, insecurity, As you look around at others, recognize it for what it is and send it on its way. It is certain that there is much pleasure and satisfaction to be gleaned from life. Patanjali says the correct fulfillment of pleasure is an essential component not only of life, but of liberation. But he also warns that wrong interaction with nature, where the afflictions or kleshas still rule us, can bring about our confusion and self-destruction. The pursuit of pleasure through appearances, which I connect here to superficiality of intent, is quite simply the wrong way to go about things. To pursue pleasure is to pursue pain in equal measure. When appearance is more important to us than content, we can be sure we have taken the wrong turning. The achievements of intelligence, therefore, also have their pitfalls, even more difficult to identify than the lure of the senses. We are only too ready to admit, "Oh, I can never resist chocolate." But how many of us would admit that we would willingly stab any colleague in the back in order to gain a promotion? We shy away from such self-knowledge as we instinctively feel that its ugliness lies closer to the soul. Most of us, at least in maturity, with or without yoga, fall into a dutiful routine, a comprehensive conduct of trying to be good and fearing the consequences if we are not. This is neither solution nor resolution, but it is a livable ceasefire or decency by dint of moderation. Controlling our desires is a continual pruning process rather than a Damascene conversion. Yama and Niyama, the ethical code, assist us in this reasoned restraint, acting as a firebreak for our behavior. Asana is a cleansing agent, and pranayama begins to tug our consciousness, chitta, away from desires and towards judicious awareness, prajna. Pratyahara is the stage at which we learn to reverse the current which flows from mind to senses, so that mind can bend its energies inwards. Dharana, concentration, brings purity to intelligence, buddhi, and dhyana, meditation, expunges the stain of ego. Concentration brings purity to intelligence. You must be protesting that throughout this, intelligence has been presented as an unalloyed good. It has received no bad press at all. This is fair enough when you're laboring up the lower slopes of the mountain of yoga. The ascension to lofty intelligence is ardently to be desired. But now we are in the sheath of intelligence itself, the Vijnana Maya Kosha, and we have to remind ourselves that the five afflictions, kleshas, taint every level of our being except the pristine soul itself. We have honed, cultured, and refined our intelligence. We have realized its power to discriminate and choose, its capacity to move us incrementally towards freedom. It is reflexive, so that we can witness ourselves. Exalted, unconditional, pure intelligence is a close and near neighbor to the soul. So why am I sounding a warning that, as the hot coal is covered by smoke, mirror by dust, embryo by the amnion, so the intoxicated intelligence covers the self? Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, verse 38, suggesting that even here its imperfections have to be sifted and only the diamonds retained? High intelligence brings the gift of power, and we all know that power corrupts. When intelligence is corrupted, it brings woe upon ourselves and upon the world. Its impurities reveal themselves in base or mixed motivation, selfish intentions, pride in the pursuit of power, self-seeking ambitions, ill will, calculation and manipulation, hypocrisy, chicanery, cunningness, arrogance, disingenuousness, and secret joy in the discomfiture of others. These impurities stem more from the cognitive aspect of intelligence, will, volition, intention, and less from its cognitive and reflective side. They contain an instinctual biological distortion expressing itself as, "What's in it for me and mine?" and contempt for others in an "I am right, you are wrong" attitude. We said that intelligence, by consulting memory, can factor in consequences. What intelligence does not do well is pick up on its own motivations, which are quietly infiltrating from ego. To see impurities of intelligence, just buy 6 different newspapers on the same day, or watch several different TV news stations. Notice how the same events come to be reported so differently. This may be simple misperception, but more likely there's a slant or a twist of interpretation which serves the agenda of the newspaper proprietors. This may be nationalistic because they have links to a governing party, or it may be a hidden economic interest. After all, most newspaper owners are by definition rich men bent on getting richer. Notice, too, what is left out and what is included. We are forced to conclude that the vaunted objectivity of media is too frequently superficial or hypocritical. This is not because the journalists' minds do not function well. They do. It is because there is subversion in their intelligence. These are called impurities, and they are very difficult to detect in ourselves. If we live outwardly virtuous lives, it is easy to convince ourselves that there is nothing else wrong with us. Often this is the besetting sin of the Puritan or religious fanatic. In our personal lives, we often both suppress the truth and suggest the false. Ego aids and abets all flaws of intelligence. These impurities of intelligence are the high crimes of humanity, and we cannot disown them. But we can get rid of them with help from the part of our consciousness that is closest to our soul. Conscience. Intelligence can be largely self-policing because it has the ability to initiate action and the ability to factor in consequences of these actions. A conscious effort to observe and identify these defects in ourselves rather than in others pays dividends. Such self-examination forms an integral part of the study and education of self, swadhyaya, which is the 4th segment of the ethical code, niyama. But still we need both a yogic technique and an independent arbiter. I shall deal with the second first. The function of independent arbiter, the witness of the witness, as it were, is fulfilled by conscience. This is the face of the lens of consciousness which faces the soul. It is less likely to be tainted by contact with the world than the outward face of the lens, which is in contact through the senses with the world around us. When this facet of consciousness, which we call in English conscience, is flawless, reflecting only the light of the soul, it is known in Sanskrit as the organ of virtue, dharmendriya. Cosmic consciousness can be considered in a way to be the soul of nature, limitless as the universe, all-embracing. That part of cosmic consciousness that is in us is the individual conscience. It is in closest proximity to the soul, purusha, and therefore has a very special relationship with the soul. It is the nearest point of contact we experience between the natural world and the spiritual world. For that reason, you could say the conscience is the perception of consequences perceived from the deepest level, that of unity. This is where soul infuses matter, our bridge between soul and nature. That is why conscience will only ever tell you one thing, or for one course of action, because it comes out of oneness. Conscience is consciousness being able to tune in to the promptings of the individual soul, Atman. Good advice can come from many sources and may all be useful in its own way, but it only leads to a resolution through analysis and synthesis, which is the brain working. Intuition often manifests as an inner voice arising from fine and sensitive intelligence. It might tell you not to take a particular job in spite of attractive appearances or to make a journey which you have not envisaged. It is to be respected, though treated with caution, at least until intelligence has reached the stage of pure wisdom. Intuition transcends rationality and is from the heart. What then is different about conscience? The difference is that conscience hurts. It causes us pain. We say we are pricked by conscience. Intuition prompts us, causes perhaps some confusion because we do not know where it's coming from. But conscience hurts. That's because it lies at the heart of the paradox of what it means to be a spiritual being living in a physical body, in a material world. Conscience tells us to do the harder thing because it is always pulling us toward unity, toward wholeness. Our desires, our selfishness, our intellectual flaws always tug us toward the world of diversity, where we judge issues, muddle through, try to choose the lesser evil. Conscience, when it's flawless, is the voice of our soul, whispering in our ear. In that sense, even a painful conscience is a privilege, as it is proof that God is still talking to us. This close juxtaposition of conscience and soul reminds me of a visit I made to Rome many years ago. Pope Paul, the then Pope, was in poor health and invited me to come and see him with a view to giving him yoga lessons. I accepted, but suddenly, at the behest of his cardinals, he imposed a condition. The lessons were to be kept a total secret, as it might be interpreted in a twisted fashion as if a Catholic pope were to be seen to be following practices associated with Hinduism. Of course, I assured him that yoga is universal, transcending any creed or cult, and I was able to say that I would not broadcast what was taking place. Nevertheless, I said, if questioned about it, I was not prepared to lie. Apparently, my truthfulness presented a security risk, and the lessons never took place. However, I did visit the Sistine Chapel and saw Michelangelo's great ceiling painting of God, reaching from a cloud, extending his finger to Adam, who in return also extends his hand toward God. Their fingers almost touch. This is what I meant by the relationship of the soul to conscience. They almost touch, and at times a divine spark passes from the heavenly outstretched hand to man's. Bliss, the divine body. Our inward journey has now taken us to the innermost core of being, to the bliss body, or divine body, Ananda Maya Kosha, that resides within us all, where our soul lives and where we can glimpse the universal oneness that embraces us all. This vision of our divinity forces us to return once again to the nature of our humanity. Before we can understand the universal soul, we must understand our own. And before we understand our own soul, we must explore all that eclipses our true selves, especially the wily I that takes on 1,000 disguises to distract us. Who am I is the fundamental question which has always existed in people's minds. Traditionally, it might have been answered to some extent by reference to one's role or primary function in society. I am a priest, a warrior, a merchant, a servant, a carpenter, a wife and mother. But the deeper implications of the question have always been present. In any case, no one is a mother or businessman or school teacher all the time, all their life. These are temporary states. Even if you say, I am a man or a woman, it is incomplete. Formerly, you were a child, and besides, does sexual identity have any importance when you are asleep? What we are really saying is, I am I, which is not very helpful. By I, we are referring to that bit of us which seems to be at the center of our perceptions, our actions, our feelings, our thoughts, our memories. It is often called the ego-based self, or egoic self. But if all we can say is, I am I, and everyone else is saying the same thing, then logically we must all be the same, which visibly and palpably we are not. So in order to explain our differences and define this I-self further, we tack on attributes and characteristics which qualify and exemplify the I in some way. A rich man might feel that I and my possessions gives a fair indication. A politician, I and my power. A chronic invalid, I and my sickness. An athlete, I and my body. A film star, I and my beauty. A professor, I and my brain. Or a bad-tempered, dissatisfied person, I and my anger. Adding a ragbag of attributes to our I-self is not only how we generally see ourselves, but how we see and describe others. The important point is that all these qualities we list are external to the I. In other words, the I identifies itself by conjoining with its surroundings. Clearly, I leapfrogged one answer to the who am I question. It is, I am a human being. For this to be a value, one has to ask the follow-up question, what then is a human being? This is exactly what yoga does, the starting point of yogic inquiry. The basic question underpinning all yoga practice is simply, what are we? Even the asana itself is an inquiry, asking in each asana, who am I? Through asana, the practitioner throws out all the extraneous parts until only the soul is left. The final correct asana is the true expression of, I am that. That is God. This expression is felt only when one approaches and performs asana within the framework of physical prowess, shakti, intellectual skillfulness, yukti, and devotion and worshipfulness, bhakti, in each asana. Let us therefore sift through everything, says yoga, every component of a human being which we can find and identify, our body, our breath, our energy, sickness and health, brain and anger, and pride in our power and possessions. Above all, it says, let us examine this mysterious I, ever present and conscious of itself, but invisible in the mirror or in any photograph. The I is so often a source of worry. I dwells in our body, and we know that the body dies, brain dies, the heart stops beating, the lungs cease to breathe, senses no longer feel. Is it therefore not possible, likely even, that the I dies too? This is disturbing. If my very identity is transient, ephemeral, what permanence is there? Is there no firm ground? Our lack of certainty is, according to yoga, of itself and by its very nature, toxic. Yoga identifies the very deepest root of all illness as being the sorrow and pain we undergo because we live in ignorance of Purusha, universal soul. Being ignorant of our true self, we identify only with aspects of the natural world, which is in a state of flux. To identify ourselves, we fix on the aspect of consciousness which dwells in the inner body, and it is called ego. There is a great gulf between the acceptance of ego as the necessary alias with which to function in the world, and mistaking that alias for our true self. Inevitably, if we fall for the impersonation of our soul by our ego, we get caught up in the turbulence of the world around us, its desires, emotional disturbances, afflictions, so-called sins, and ailments or obstacles. Inevitably, I say, because our ego consciousness is part of that hungry, seeking, insatiable, frantic world. In other words, we have no firm base. We want to be immortal. We know in our hearts that we are, but we throw it all away by misidentifying with all that is perishable and transient. When we first asked the question, who am I? What we were truly hoping for was to discover an enduring identity beyond role or function or attribute, a real self, real in the sense that it is not menaced by the mortality of the flesh, but which is permanent and unchanging. That is why yoga examines the totality of being, every layer of existence from body inwards, sorting, testing, observing, experimenting, dissecting, and classifying until a full blueprint of the human being is built up. The ancient yogis and philosopher saints systematically did this until they found the light they were looking for, the eternal, unchanging self, the part of us which answers once and for all the original, inevitable question, who am I? Their gift to us lies in the knowledge and techniques and maps of their search which they bequeathed to us, so that we too can each answer our own question, since it is certain no one else can answer it for us. We will explore the nature of this eternal, unchanging self, but before we can, we must discover the five afflictions that eclipse our comprehension and cause so much of our suffering. The ancient yogis tried to work out a plan by which human evolution, both individually and collectively, could progress. In doing so, the ancient sages naturally asked themselves the question, what is making things go wrong? Why, in spite of our best intentions, does something always send things awry? Are we programmed forever to sabotage our own aspirations? Their inquiry led them to the five afflictions that we all experience. The five afflictions, kleshas. The afflictions are a particular pattern of disturbance to the human consciousness, as universal and prevalent as fruit flies to healthy apples. Our state of mind at any given moment is a wave pattern. It is incredibly complex. It is constantly modified by outside stimuli, an advertisement, an unkind word, a smile from a friend. Rising thoughts from the unconscious and memory confuse it further. A wish, a regret. But there are more enduring patterns of interference, which I shall explain now. They are as inbuilt in us as fruit flies are in the life cycle of apples. They are called the polluting fluctuations of consciousness or afflictions, kleshas. They corrupt our lives and vitiate our best intentions to ripen as a person. There are five afflictions. They are natural, innate, and they afflict us all. The first of them is, in effect, the father of the other four. If you can overcome it, you will have turned night into day. Whereas certain schools of thought, especially in the West, make an amalgam of the forces of evil and call it the devil, yogic thought begs to differ. It too makes an amalgam of all the forces which lead men to perform evil and perverse deeds. The difference is that Western thought ascribes the attribute of intelligence to evil. The devil is a clever devil, sophisticated in the arts of corruption and possessing an independent consciousness separate from and antithetical to the aims of man and God. This is a situation of unending conflict between two intelligent and sentient forces, one good and the other evil. The devil of yoga is not intelligent. He is ignorant. In fact, he is ignorance itself. We often think that ignorance means you don't know the capital of Albania. What yoga means by ignorance can perhaps be translated as nescience, which simply means not knowing. So to Hindus, the arch enemy is a state of not knowing. What don't we know when we are ignorant? The answer is this. You don't know what is real and what is not real. You don't know what is enduring and what is perishable. You don't know who you are and who you are not. Your whole world is upside down because you take the artifacts in your living room to be more real than the unity that connects us all, more real than the relations and obligations that unite us all. Perceiving the links and associations which bind the cosmos in a seamless whole is the object of yoga's journey of discovery. It is this idea that we live in a totally topsy-turvy world which gives rise to the saying that what is day for the ordinary man is night for the wise and vice versa. There's a famous phrase by a metaphysical poet who said, "A fool who persists in his folly will become wise." The European medieval humanist Erasmus wrote a book called In Praise of Folly. From Europe to the Far East, there's a tradition that human perception is so totally flawed that it frequently is the saintly idiot who is wiser than all his seemingly sensible neighbors. What this means is that we are not required simply to adjust our vision, but to turn it inside out as well as outside in, a complete reversal. It means that the ultimate truth is inconceivable in normal consciousness. These statements about ignorance, in Sanskrit called avidya, are challenging. There are various ways to explain them. They are mostly so revolutionary that they require the use of paradox. The Lord Jesus explained it well. He said that if you build a house on sand, it will founder. If you build it on rock, it will stand firm. This means that a life must be built on a foundation of reality which is firm. Unfortunately, what seems firm, that is to say, the things of life which offer us security, wealth, possessions, prejudices, beliefs, privilege, and position, are not solid at all. That refers back to when I said that learning to live with uncertainty is the great art of living. Jesus also means that only a life built on spiritual values, dharma, is based firmly in truth and will stand up to the shocks of life. You could put it this way: all mankind lives unwittingly within the truth of yoga. Yoga is one. No one escapes the mechanism of, as you sow, so shall you reap. Yet we deny the totality of our vision. We find ourselves in the position of having to portion it up, to compartmentalize, to cherry-pick what suits us, and reject what does not. Why? It's because we all misapprehend reality. Not just partially, but totally. Only the supreme renunciate, Bhaktan, is capable, with one peerless gesture of surrender, of turning the universe inside out and outside in. In the West, this is exemplified by St. Francis of Assisi embracing a leper because he perceived a soul identical to his own within. We others simply cannot. We are like the man who has put his shirt on inside out and back to front. The only way he can rectify his error is to take it off, work out how it should be, and start again. Through yoga, we take off the shirt of our ignorance, study it, and put it back on correctly as a shirt of knowledge. To do this, we examine, like the man turning out the body in each sleeve of his shirt separately, each petal of yoga as if it were separate. Just as our man knows that there's only one shirt, we should not forget that there is only one yoga. Spiritual values are not the sauce on the dish of material life, perhaps only to be indulged in on Sunday. They are the main dish, that which nourishes and sustains us. Material values are the sauce, and they can help to make life extremely pleasant. In moderation and tasted with detachment, they will make this world a paradise. But they do not endure. Ignorance, avidya, prevents us from seeing the truth. What does not endure is the egoic self, me. The undiscovered soul endures the misperception that I am me. It is this egoic me which does not want to die. This impersonation of soul by ego is at the base of all human woes, and this is the root of avidya, ignorance or nescience. Ignorance is, in its essence, taking the day-to-day self we know for the immortal self, the true self or soul. If you combine that with the fifth affliction, which is fear of death and clinging to life, it means that a great deal of human activity throughout all ages is an attempt to perpetuate the existence of the ego itself through name, fame, wealth, glory, or achievement. Yet the soul endures, and the known ego will perish, as does its outward sheath, the body. This is mankind's hard predicament, that what he believes himself to be, his ego and attributes, are perishable, whereas what man merely senses himself to be, transcendent consciousness and soul, will endure. We cannot endure the loss of the known. We have insufficient faith to place trust in the survival of the unknown. Yoga's answer is to say, discover the unknown and you will encounter your own immortality. I cannot stress sufficiently that the five afflictions are interwoven into the fiber of all our beings. They are not like defects, such as laziness or greed, which we may or may not have. They are wave patterns of interference, which stem from our glorious individuality, biological, psychological, and spiritual. They are the fundamental misapprehension of the relationship which the part, our individual selves, has in relationship to the whole, nature and divinity. Without a clear appreciation of what we receive from the whole and what we contribute back to the well-being of the whole, we are left howling in the wilderness. No lovers, servants, riches, cars, houses, or public acclaim can salve the wound of a dysfunctional relationship with our origin. Know your Father, said Lord Jesus. By this statement, he was directly addressing the problem of not knowing, avidya. The other four afflictions are the shoots of the root, avidya. The first affliction that emerges from avidya is called pride, asmita. Pride leads to arrogance. Arrogance leads to what the Greeks called hubris, that is, vying with the gods for preeminence. Destruction is the certain result. Yogically, all that it means is that the fragile and the beautiful stem of individuality, which resides in each one of us, pure in origin and intention, meets as it sprouts the phenomenon of the external world. Clothes, girls, boys, cars, position, titles, money, power, influence, and subsequently is colored by them. Asmita, I-ness, is pure and colorless, both in origin and when knowledge of wisdom is established. It is purity and singularity without defining attributes. But as it meets the world, it becomes tainted, colored by contact, and becomes pride. It assumes the attributes which seem to cluster around it and loses its pristine beauty. That is the beauty we see in a young child before the world had sullied his or her innocence. So Asmita, our unique and stainless individuality, can, through the saddening and obscure years of life, harden into an exclusive shell of selfishness, of me, of pride. This pride lies in difference, not in equality. You are pretty. I am ugly. I am fierce. You are weak. I own a house. You're a beggar. I am right. You are wrong. It is, in effect, ignorance, not knowing, raised to the level of a political platform. It is the insanity of individualism, when it should be the joy of singularity. Pride blinds us to the quality of others. We judge by externals and by worthless comparisons. We lose the possibility of joy in the existence of others. We expect others to perform according to our desires and expectations. We are constantly dissatisfied. To borrow a golfing metaphor, we lose the ability to play the ball where it lies. The first two afflictions, ignorance, not knowing, and pride, are considered to be wave patterns of interference operating at an intellectual level. The next two, attachment, raga, and aversion, dvesha, influence us more at an emotional level. We must be careful with language here. When we say, I'm very attached to my wife, we mean, I love her. So it's only a matter of speaking. What raga really means is obsessive or perverted love, a conflation of the egoic self with the object of one's attachment. We have all witnessed the car owner who, faced with a tiny scratch to the bodywork of his vehicle, leaps from it like a berserk warrior who's received a wound in battle. What we witness here is a fusion and an absolute identification between the ego, which does not endure, and an object in its possession, which does not endure either. We all know the phrase concerning death, you can't take it with you. This is true. I cannot take my ego beyond the grave, and I certainly can't take my car, my land, or my bank account. The dominant word here is my. You can easily see how this is the child of ignorance, one impermanent entity seeking an enduring link with another impermanent entity. It is quite insane from a logical point of view, which is why I said earlier that we must take off the shirt of ignorance and turn it inside out. There's no way to adjust it when you're still wearing it. The word raga therefore applies to the magnetic attraction between ego and the pleasant objects which surround it. The correct attitude to our possessions is gratitude, not ownership. Towards our car, we should feel gratitude that it conveys us safely and allows us to see places we would not otherwise have seen. I'm grateful to the table I'm writing on. It makes this book possible. Whether it is my table or not is irrelevant. In India, we have every year a ceremony in which we garland our household objects and thank them for the service they render us. We borrow their services for a certain time and are grateful. But the table is the table and will probably still be doing its job long after my death, but not indefinitely. What, you must be asking, is the case when someone you love dies? You are sundered. There's a rending pain of separation. Of course there is. But this is not raga. I lost my wife suddenly, brutally, unexpectedly. I was not even there, but was away teaching in Mumbai for the weekend. I could not get back in time. I did not cry at her funeral. My soul loved her soul. This is love. It is transcendental and transcends the separation of death. If my ego, my small self, had been the source of my feelings for her, then I would have cried. And mostly I would have been crying for myself. There's nothing wrong with shedding tears for ones we love. But we must know for whom they are shed, for the loss of those who remain, and not for those who've departed. But as the poet says, death shall have no dominion. Aversion, dvesha, is the opposite side of attachment. It is a repulsion which leads to enmity and hate, like the same poles of two magnets pushing away from each other. Again, it is based on superficialities. My essence cannot hate your essence, because they are the same. I may deplore your behavior, but it is nonsense to deduce that therefore I hate you. If I, on occasion, have deplored my own behavior, does that mean I should hate my own soul, hate the divinity within? Of course not. I should correct my behavior. Again, it is ignorance which plays the puppet master and sows confusion. If we conflate what people do with who they are in their deepest origin, we lock ourselves into an adversarial and aggressive crouch, an unending conflict. By doing so, we sign up for a permanent war between good and evil, which cannot be won. All we should seek is for evildoers to reform their deeds. The best way to help them is to reform our own deeds, and then we may well discover that all mankind is much of a muchness, one essence common to all, and that all our woes stem from the fundamental misperception of ignorance. Ignorance here comes to mean the denial of original oneness, or universal community. The final wave pattern or affliction which influences our lives is experienced at an instinctual level. At an instinctual level, it makes good sense, as we are all animals trying to stay alive. It is when we upgrade a natural survival mechanism to inappropriate levels that trouble arises. It is called fear of death or clinging to life, abhinivesha. Naturally, when you are sick, your biological body clings to life. It's supposed to. This is the struggle for existence, the reasonable desire to prolong the life of the vehicle of the soul. After all, it's not like a car. You cannot just buy another one. You have to keep your body as healthy as possible on the spiritual path. We all identify with our bodies. This is inevitable. If an elephant charges towards us as we cross the road, we do not cry, "My God, my ego will be crushed." At that moment, we are our body, which jumps out of the way. This is largely true when we are ill. Good health banishes body identification to a degree nothing else can. We accept that, in the long run, we are not our body. Body perishes. We hope we will not. But you cannot tell that to pain. We may know that the body is not our enduring identity, but that knowledge is theoretical. In health, we forget our body. In sickness, we cannot. How much simpler life would be if this were the other way around. In relation to the body, this means that we are not our body in any permanent sense. But for all practical purposes, we are our body, because it is the vehicle through which we perceive and can discover our immortality. This is why yoga begins with the body. Nevertheless, we accept that the body will perish, lamentable though it may be. What we do, however, find intolerable is the fact that I shall die, that my ego is as perishable as my flesh. This brings us back to ignorance. Our ego is the most intimate and interior part of ourselves that most of us know. If ego perishes, we fear that we shall be engulfed in darkness, in an everlasting void. So we conclude that we must perpetuate ego at all costs, through dynasties, fame, great buildings, all immortality projects aimed at cheating the Grim Reaper. What rubbish, says yoga. Ego is an important component of consciousness which you require to operate your body during its life. Beyond that, it has no purpose. But consciousness is much more than our ego. It is even, according to yoga, more than our mind. Scientists are beginning to ask the question, how does mind give rise to consciousness? Yoga would ask, how does consciousness give rise to the mind? it is its precursor and not limited by the physicality of the mind. Consciousness exists at a microcosmic level, that is, smaller than the atom. According to some scientists, cosmic intelligence exists at a quantum level. Mind, manas, is the most physical and external part of consciousness. Being the most material or manifest, its fortunes are linked to those of the body for good or ill, which is why a car accident can leave you brain dead, but not consciousness dead. In near-death experiences, people retain a form of awareness, but without its constituent parts. Even when all neurosystems, including memory, have totally shut down, consciousness continues as a witness, though at a level which cannot yet be scientifically perceived. Because intelligence, buddhi, exists in us as a particle of universal phenomenon, it cannot be totally eclipsed, even when we suffer physical damage. In the same way, soul cannot be killed. Only its vehicle can die. Look for the light. Ego is not the source of light. Consciousness transmits the divine light of origin of the soul. But it is like the moon. It reflects the light of the sun. It has no light of its own. Find the sun, says yoga. Discover the soul. That is what Hatha Yoga means. Ha is the sun, the self. Ta is the moon of consciousness. When the lens of consciousness is perfect and clean, it will be clear that its illuminating light is the innermost soul. The final ascension. There remains much to learn and much literally soul-searching work to be done. I said that we have to apply our observation concerning the afflictions to ourselves. Therefore, we need a mirror. So we have to continue our practice of yoga, all aspects of the practice we have learned hitherto. We have to refine what we already can accomplish and add new depth and subtleties in order to penetrate into the final heart of the mystery. We have to keep on questioning ourselves, or else transformation will not take place. Advance with faith, yes, but always call yourself into question. Where there is pride, there is always ignorance. Before consciousness finally gravitates to ourself, and ourself is merged in the infinite, there are many fine threads to be woven together into the shimmering cloth of our practice. We have to weave in a meditation of such selfless purity that the impersonating ego will be unmasked for all time. When the ego is effaced, the afflictions which accompany it will disappear. Another thread that we must weave in is an understanding of how the elements inform our practice. I discussed earlier the elements of earth, water, fire, and air, and how they correspond to the first four sheaths of body, energy, mind, and intellect. The final element that corresponds with the final sheath of bliss is called space, and allows mobility and freedom in all the others. Space is the most subtle and pervasive element, and we must learn to tame it. Space, sometimes translated as ether, is not the ether of the modern chemist. It is taken in its old sense as being the space permeating the emptiness between particles of matter. The amount of matter inside an atom is equivalent to a tennis ball inside a cathedral. So our atoms, and therefore we, are almost entirely space. The space above us, the sky, is Mahat Akasha, cosmic intelligence in space, while the self within is Chit Akasha, or Chid Akasha, cosmic intelligence inside us. One is the external space, the other is the internal space. But to yogis, the felt space of the self is actually larger than that of the external space surrounding them. Space is emblematic of freedom, the freedom which only space allows for movement. For is not change itself a movement? The view which astronauts gained from outer space often left them with the unified, nonpartisan, borderless perception of the planet Earth, which changed their lives and led them to try to impart their experience through the pursuit of shared human goals to be achieved by peaceful cooperation. As I have said, we cannot all go into orbit, but we do have access to space, our inner space. Paradoxically, looking within has a comparable unifying effect as visiting space does for astronauts. I make no excuse for repeating that inside the microcosm of the individual exists the macrocosm of the universe. If this truism, however obvious to you or however unlikely, does not hold good, then all yoga is nonsense, along with Gnostic mysticism, Sufism, Buddhism, and the teachings of Christ. The wisdom which yoga practice has given me was confirmed through the sacred yoga books that I have read. Not only have I acquired knowledge by my sadhana and the reading of sacred texts, but also through my travels and the people I have met. All these weave together the last threads of our yogic cloth. The writers of the Vedas were seers, but also poets and visionaries who saw divinity everywhere, in everything, in animate and inanimate, organic and inorganic things. Somehow we've lost that art. Stagnation has brought insensitivity, but echoes of wisdom persist. The great Catalan architect Gaudi, for example, said that architecture was a creative relationship between the sensuousness of nature and the austerity of geometry. This is a theme which runs through yoga practice. My attempts systematically to impose symmetry on asana postures express this relationship. And, as with the architect, the concept of space is fundamental. A vase, like a building, like a body, has two spaces, the one that it contains and the one that surrounds it. When we begin asana, we worry about the shape of the pose, that is, how we look in the mirror. In other words, the space we exclude. By now we should be worrying about the space we include, the space within, for it is largely that which gives true life and beauty to the asana. It is called yoga svarupa, the self assuming its perfect form through yoga. That is achieved through the inner distribution of space. Essentially, that is how yoga asana becomes effortless, with the natural beauty of molten gold being poured from a vat. To reach the infinite, we have to use finite means, as does the architect, even if he is building a cathedral or a temple. And like the architect, yoga science says that you have to align your inner and outer bodies so that they run parallel and are in communication with each other. Without correct alignment, a building falls down. Gaudi sought to express the sublime through the physical. It is the same for the yoga practitioner. Alignment creates an intercommunicating structure, which, like a cathedral, is an offering to God. That is why, for me, alignment is a metaphysical word. Correct alignment creates correct space, as in a well-constructed building. A building without a spacious interior is a lump of stone, a megalith. Can you imagine a body like that? It would be both inert and uninhabitable. According to Indian philosophy, art is of two types. One is called bhogakala, the art of appeasing the pleasure of the body and mind. The other is yogakala, the art of auspicious performance to please the spiritual heart of the soul. All arts have science and art. Bliss, ananda, is experienced and expressed when the goal is to bring order out of chaos, wisdom out of ignorance, divinity out of aesthetics. Do you wonder that I become angry when my students throw away their God-given talents on boga yoga, look good, feel good, but do no good yoga? The drive within nature is to express itself through evolution. That is especially obvious to anyone living in a tropical country like India. Nature wants to occupy every space. That is mirrored in our language when we say that nature abhors a vacuum. Nature sees its role as expressing itself in more and more variety, and often to our eyes, in more and more beauty, but not always in beauty. Nature can overwhelm us. Why did yogis go to the Himalayas? Was it to find space, an outer space, to reflect an inner? Earlier, I related air to touch and to intelligence. I said we both inhale and bathe in it. Space is even more intimate, more pervasive, since all of our atoms are mostly composed of space. sound and vibration correspond to space and can travel through them like radio waves that we send out through space in the expectation that intelligence will someday be able to communicate fully. Is sound not even more powerful and more intimate than air? The vibration of a whale's song can penetrate hundreds of miles of ocean. Is not the sound of God, Om, more holy than any idol? Is not music the highest art? Vibration is a wave. It comes from three points, all that is needed to make a sine curve, and it is the first step of manifestation. It is very close to the root of nature and is very powerful for that reason. As I have said, when you collapse your posture, you collapse your soul. When you collapse the space, you collapse the soul. The eyes are the index of the brain. The ears are the index of consciousness. The eyes belong to mind and fire, the ears to awareness and space. When one is in a meditative state, the frontal brain is resting and without interruption. Whenever we are thinking about a problem, we lean our heads forward. If you let your head drop forward in meditation, the frontal brain will feel distress. But if there is harmony between the eyes and the ears, the focusing of awareness becomes easy. The eyes are the window of the brain. The ears are the window of the soul. This is contrary to popular wisdom. But when the senses are withdrawn, pratyahara, this is the true experience. The ears are able to discern vibration. Our inner space corresponds to what we normally call heaven. This is how we can hear the divinity of our inner heaven before we see it. The ears also witness silence. Silence is the music of samadhi. Let me be more prosaic. Just as we cannot separate the element of earth from the sheath of our physical body, anamaya kosha, so we cannot separate space from the blissful sheath, anandamaya kosha. In asana, we are playing with the elements. When we twist, for example, we are squeezing space out of the kidney, and on release, space returns, but space renewed. In a similar way, we are squeezing water, fire, air, as well as, to some extent, earth, out of an organ when we twist or contract. When we release, circulation comes back, restoring revitalized elements. We think of this as washing and cleansing the organs. This is true, but at the elemental level, what we are doing is playing with the balance of the elements, experiencing which sensation each will bring us. In a twist, it is not only the organ that is twisted, but the bones, muscle, fiber, and nerves. The vessels carrying liquid will also be constricted. The mind will take on a different form corresponding to the unusual shape of the body. The intelligence will touch the body in a different way, and the vibration which the body emits will be altered. For example, I am able to feel the vibration of each kidney and to compare the difference between them. This twist will also bring into evidence the subtle qualities or counterparts associated with each element. For example, it will make us aware of the density, strength, and scent of the body's clay, the flexibility and taste of the body's fluids, the vitality and vision of the mind's fire, the clarity and touch of the ambient intelligence of air, and the freedom and inner vibration of the ethereal space within the body. This is how we learn to discern and appreciate the subtle elements of nature of which we are composed. It is like lila, the Sanskrit term for the cosmic game, but played at a very high level. As animals learn the arts of survival by playing when they are cubs and puppies, so for us, this game is an essential step in learning how to survive in the subtle heart of nature. It is exploration through play, through trial and error. When we can play with the elements within our own body, with their renewal and disproportion and rebalancing, then we are aware of nature at a level which is not apprehendable in a normal way. It is supernatural, as normal consciousness is blind to it. We are discovering evolution through a journey of involution, like a salmon swinging back up the torrent from which he was born to spawn again. We must now look at the evolution of nature itself, so like the yogi, like a Himalayan Sherpa may achieve his final ascension and conquest. Only when he stands on the peak of nature will the yogi meet his soul, Purusha, and also Purusha Vishesha, the universal soul. To stand on it, in truth, is to understand it. The evolution of nature.